My name is Jorge Millares, and I am a first-generation American from Cuban descent.
My name is Diana Nicholas, and I identify as Haitian-American.
Emmanuel Aqua, I am Ghanaian-American.
Jeannie Marianne Goja Francisco, because we love long names in the Philippines, is where I'm from, so I'm Filipino-American.
Childhood memory that made me aware of my gender, I guess there's a couple, it's probably a compilation of a few. The very first one was, so I grew up in a Cuban-American home, and my stepfather, you know, kind of telling me, hey, you know what, this is the role of a man, you know, the man, and again, very traditional, which is very different than the way that we think about it now, where, you know, the way he was explaining things to me then is the woman in the kitchen, you know, the men go to work, man gets home from work, sits on the couch, just relaxes, drinks a beer, watch a baseball game. So for me, I think that was one particular one because he's explaining to me that role. Now, I'll tell you, in my home, it's very different. But that's one. And I think another one, which I was actually talking to a friend about 2 days ago, was in school. And I don't know if y'all remember this, but okay, we're doing push-ups in PE. Girl push-ups and then regular push-ups, which today, I'll be honest, I know some women that could do more push-ups than I can by far, probably about half of them. You know, so I think that was just something that really made me think, well, why is it that the women are just kind of viewed as that the girls have to do the girl push-ups and the men have to do the so-called harder push-ups? And I don't know, I guess that's something that just stands out to me because, again, these days I don't agree with it, but it's funny how, you know, growing up in the 80s and 90s, that was the case. It was really interesting.
I've always been a tomboy. I just liked it. I think once I moved to the South is when I understood that, no, you know, there is such a thing as a Southern Belle down here. And the guys down here do not like strong personalities. Not that I will ever get rid of it, but it definitely has made me more aware of my femininity. Like now I do dress up. I don't leave the house without powder on my face. You know, my eyes are always done. And I actually enjoyed it. I didn't think I would enjoy it as much. Like, don't get me wrong. I'll put my Jordans on if I have to.
Yeah.
But, you know, being a woman and being, especially at 41, going on 42, I embrace it even more now than I did when I was younger.
An early childhood memory that really got me being as feminine as I am, I would say, is that my sister, I was basically her human Barbie doll. She used to dress me up and make me take pictures. And I'm like, you're so weird. Like, why won't you do this herself? Because she was such a tomboy growing up. And I think she felt like she had to be a tomboy. It runs in our family that, like, we just have, not that I have an amazing body, but, like, we just have, like, a body that is very feminine. And she used to cover that up a ton, and she used to tell me how she used to cover it up a ton because she, like, always got these vibes from men that was very, like, sexual, and she did not like that at all. So she just became super tomboy, and because I think she really is such a feminine person, and she grew up to be, I mean, she's very feminine. She's such a girl, which I love. And she used to dress me up in all the things that she used to love. And so she would dress me up, and I'm 12 years younger than she is. And it just really instilled this, like, femininity about, like, myself. And so I identify as very, like, female and very just, like, whatever you want to name that. Feminine.
When did I identify myself as male, or I guess the earliest memory? I mean, to be honest with you, for as long as I can remember, I don't think I've ever asked myself that question. I think it was just something I just was, you know? I mean, I grew up in a Ghanaian home. My mom and dad never really, you know, had the typical gender roles in our house because, I mean, when both your parents are immigrants and they're trying to make ends meet for four kids, you know, they're both going to work, they're both doing a lot, and everybody has responsibility in the house. And me being the oldest of four, it was watching over my younger siblings a lot of the time, you know? So when it comes to that, I mean, typically it's like Jorge, you mentioned your stepfather kind of said the woman is typically the caregiver and does right. All this stuff. But in our home, I mean, it was kind of the, it's everybody steps up to the plate. Mm-hmm. Like my dad cooks because my mom was a nurse, and so she's working like 12-hour shifts, and she wouldn't be home sometimes.
Right.
And then when my dad wasn't there, my mom would step in. But I guess, I mean, if you say I have to pick a memory, I'd probably say it's very much linked to sports and athletics, because I was naturally talented as a younger kid, and I was super competitive and strong-willed, and I just knew, I mean, so everything I did was competition, pretty much, at a young age. But even then, looking back at my life, I think a lot of what I was attracted to in females was a woman who was similar to me in terms of competitive and very strong-willed and very much their own individual.
Yeah, and I gotta, I'll tell you, man, I'm really glad I wasn't limited to not cooking, because I make a mean steak, man.
See, I'll have to take you up on that.
Yeah, I
think for me, get this going.
Yeah, for me, I didn't want to be like my mom. Like, my mom would come home, cook dinner, and then we'd have to wait for my dad, and then my dad would get first pick. And I'm like, nope, that will not be me. I am not cooking for anyone. I'm sorry. And my sister, you know, she was Susie Homemaker. She was like, okay, you know, make sure dad ate. And I'm like, no. Like, even now, when my dad's like, I'm hungry, well, you have 2 feet, like, and two hands. Go get your own food. Like, I'm not getting it for you.
Yep.
Welcome to First Gens. This is a podcast about first-generation Americans and filling in the blanks beside the hyphen. I am Perrine/Perrine.
I mean, I don't have any slashes. I'm just Sky/Sky.
You know what I meant. Sometimes just for like the new people. Sometimes if my cousins are listening and they're like, why is she calling herself Perrine? I have to, you know, remind them.
Rewind it back to
season one.
I was going to say, that's what our archives are for.
Yes, the archives are there for a reason, for purpose.
Go back and listen to any and every episode.
That would be awesome.
We're great. Get caught up. Just keep listening to our voices. They're very soothing when you're trying to fall asleep.
I don't know how soothing my voice is, but
okay,
you know,
yours
definitely.
Mine is very soothing.
I'll be honest. I'll keep it real.
Yeah, I appreciate you.
But we're back.
We're back.
It's season two. We're so happy to be coming live at, well,
it's not live. It's not really live. It's a recording.
Well, we're coming.
Thank you for sticking with us,
y'all.
Yes,
thank you. Having your headphones in or just blasting us in your car or listening to us at work.
Or on the train. If you're on the train, just like take your headphones out and just let everybody listen, child.
Just share it with the world.
Yes.
Yeah.
Sharing is caring.
It is indeed. So we kind of mentioned in our last like promo for the season, for season two, we're tapping on the topic of gender. So every episode this season, we're going to be relating it back to gender, how it relates in a multitude of different facets of life. We're going to be talking about gender identity, gender expression, and so, so, so much more. And so we're really excited to kind of have this overarching theme because obviously it makes a huge part of Sky and I's identity.
Yes, gender is a large part of any and everyone's life, no matter whether you notice it or not. So we wanted to make sure that this season we, you know, we're laser focused on one specific topic, and gender is what we decided to come up on. And I think it's just, you know, very timely. And so I'm glad that we're going to be talking about it with y'all.
Yes, we're so excited. Specifically, so for this episode, we really wanted to tap a little bit on gender roles, kind of what that means, how that kind of played on our lives. But, you know, Sky is a very interesting and amazing individual, you know, and
interesting and amazing. It's me. Hi.
So she's going to break it down a little bit for us. Like, Sky, what exactly is a gender role?
I'm going to break down.
Thank you, Janet.
So you're welcome. We actually are birthday twins, me and Janet Jackson. Just want to put that out there for the record, y'all.
Fun fact.
May 16th. Yes, Tauruses. How y'all doing? Rise up.
Okay.
So what do we mean by gender, y'all? Perrine wanted to do like a Merriam-Webster definition here, but we're going to do Ramita Wilson the definition. Because honestly, I just looked at the Merriam-Webster and it's trash. So
why is it trash?
Because it says nothing.
Okay.
Okay. So the reason why the Merriam-Webster definition is trash is because it goes into the idea of biological sex, mm-hmm. And defining gender as one's biological sex, which is trash. Because sex, when a baby is born, is basically determined by the outward appearance of genitalia. So back in the day, they would call folks, and I'm going to use something that is considered a slur now, but I'm using it in a historical context. So please, I'm kind of giving a content and a trigger warning for folks. But in the past, folks were considered like hermaphrodites if they were born with quote unquote ambiguous genitalia. And so the way that the doctors would determine whether a baby was quote unquote a boy or a girl and the sex of the baby was by doing a ruler test. And so if the outward genitalia, was past a certain amount, certain length, then they would be considered a boy. And if it was not, then the baby would be considered a girl. And that's it. That doesn't consider anything about chromosomes. That doesn't consider anything about hormones. Yeah. That doesn't consider like the person right. that they're determining this for, which is a baby, which is not yet a sentient human being yet. It's just kind of a being right. That hasn't, come into their own. And so really, like, doctors define what a person's sex is. And so in the dictionary definition that Merriam-Webster has, it really bases it all on sex, when we really know that gender is a thing that is innately felt by a person. It's something that is innately, an idea that's innately held by that person. So everyone knows that they're their own gender, and that's really self-determined and not necessarily... made up of anything but quote unquote biological or medically speaking.
Gotcha. Wow. I didn't even know about like the ruler test.
Oh girl, it's a hot mess.
A hot ancient mess. Mm-hmm.
That's still happening to this day.
That's still happening. So mm-hmm. actually not ancient at all.
Right.
So yeah, that's so interesting because obviously we know that there's way, way more to gender. Thank you so much for breaking that down.
Anytime.
I just had a little history lesson. I hope you did too.
A herstory lesson.
Yes. So we're going to kind of talk a little bit about gender roles, specifically gender roles in our households. Mm-hmm. So growing up as a Liberian American, I saw... in my home, my father, the breadwinner, I saw him working multiple jobs to support his family. My mother was My mother is a teacher's assistant for an elementary school. She just retired in 2017. And growing up, it was very interesting to see my mother and father's dynamics within the household. I saw my father, who is a professor at North Carolina A&T State University.
Aggie Pride? I didn't go
Shout
there,
Shout out
y'all.
To the Aggies. No, she didn't. But,
but my brother did, though.
Yes. So my father was a professor at A&T, and he taught within, the School of Agriculture. And, previous to that, he was, the dean of the Liberia University's School of Agriculture as well. So he was an agriculturalist. That was his
farming.
All the farming, all of the things.
Farming.
In me, I can barely keep my houseplants alive, and it's fine. And so it's very interesting. Yeah. So my father did that. That was his 9-to-5. But don't get it twisted. That's not all my father did. My father knew that he wanted to prepare his children for their future and taking on the gender role of, provider and the one that was supposed to really be the breadwinner and to be kind of alpha male-esque. He worked multiple jobs so that my mother could, teach and do her full-time job as well. But that my mother could also be at home after school, with us to raise us. And not saying that he wasn't present. He was very present, within our childhood. But I think that it was very interesting that, you know, he kind of had to overcompensate to equal out, I think, the household income and salary, and how that differentiated drastically between he and like what my mother made. And so we just saw him work a lot, excessively. So he worked at A&T, he fried chicken with his students at a restaurant, he sold records and albums, he was a musician, and did a ton of other things as well. So it was just really interesting seeing how he met ends meet. And so when my father did pass away when I was 8 years old, our household dynamic shift dramatically and drastically. So it went from my father being the breadwinner and primary provider, and my mother also contributing, but my father being the primary provider, to my mother being the sole provider and being the one who not only was the sole income for the home, but also the one who was, you know, raising and teaching my sisters and I about, you know, being a woman and all of the things that come along with that, but also raising my brother and teaching him all of the aspects and dynamics of being a man. And that was something that was very, I think I look back now and I have a lot of sympathy for my brother, but at the same time, I'm even more proud of the man that he's become today because of so much that he had to go through and kind of figure out on his own and had to get from another perspective. And it makes me take my hat off even more to my mother and give her even more of a round of applause because she did both roles. You know, like, she raised us and she was able to give us all of those tools, being like the mother and father and whatnot on both ends.
Yeah. Yeah, I had a very different experience growing up in my household. So growing up, I remember kind of like the idea of like the woman being the one to like do the cooking and the cleaning and all of that never really made sense to me, because like it was something that like I saw in the media and that like I was told as a child, like by my mom and by my like, you know, other family members, that like this is the role that women do. But at the same time, like, my dad was the one who cooked every single day for my mom and him. He, you know, made Liberian food every day or every other day, depending on how much food they consumed. And he was the one, like, on the weekends who would, like, be doing the laundry. And, like, my mom had to, like, you know, like, clean the bathrooms. And, like, we, like, helped her, like, with vacuuming and dusting and things like that. But, like, the majority of the housework was done by my dad. Sorry, Mom, but it's true. Like, she always says that, like, he made her very lazy because, like, he liked to do stuff around the house. So, like, I always heard of this mythical land where, like, the woman was, like, the cleaner and the cooker and this, that, and the third, and a woman's place is in the kitchen. But, like, I looked in the kitchen, and it was just my dad alone, like, listening to talk radio and, you know, like, washing the dishes and doing his thing.
And he was whipping it up.
Yeah, my dad could cook, such y'all. My father was the best cook. Like, one thing that, like, my father passed away a few years ago, and one of the things I miss the most about him is his food. Like, every time I go home, like, my mom will cook something for me, and I'm like, this was good, but Papa's okra sauce, y'all. She knows it's true. But so yeah, like, I always heard of these things, but they didn't necessarily, my parents never fit into those boxes. Yeah. And it was funny because my mom is a very, like, just like traditionally feminine person, like, you know, heels, makeup, has to be dressed, hair is on point all the time. Mm-hmm. Like, just like this, like, high femme woman, and just gorgeous and beautiful and regal. And my dad was like the stereotypical, like, stoic man, like, particularly like stoic West African man. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't talk much and, like, I don't show emotions, except for with me. You know, I was the only girl. So, like, he was very affectionate with me. And, like, he was affectionate with my brothers, but in a very different way. But, like, in those ways, the way that they, like, interacted with us, like, they very much played into the stereotypical, like, gender roles of, like, you know, maternal, like, being very, you know, maternal and expressive and loving and doting and
Your
all
brothers?
That stuff. No, my mom, with my mom,
Your
with
mom.
Like, yeah, on my brothers and I.
Okay.
And then like my dad, like this more stoic, silent, strong type.
Right.
And like he definitely was like the breadwinner. He paid, I mean, he was the one who like wrote the checks for all the bills and managed all the household finances. Mm-hmm. So he definitely like still fit into a lot of those roles still. Mm-hmm. But like there was just a lot of like blurring of gender norms and roles in the household that like when I was growing up, I always thought like, well, I don't have to always be the one to cook because he cooking and she ain't doing nothing. She's just sitting on the couch watching her stories. So why can't I sit on the couch and watch my stories like when I get up, grow up and, you know, get married? But like in some ways there was like a lot of blurring the lines. But in other ways, they still definitely like supported those gender norms and gender roles within us. And when I wanted to, you know, like play with the boys and like go outside and roughhouse, it was still frowned upon, though, you know, things in the household weren't, you know, leave it to beaver status.
It's just really interesting because like my mom like always bakes, like she's like the baker, like
her mama makes the best
bakes the things.
Cakes, y'all. My gosh.
She's like the ultimate pound cake queen and everyone like loves her cakes and everything. And so, yeah, like my mom like liked to cook and she would cook. But I even remember like, because as a single parent, we kind of had to jump in and be very independent for ourselves, like at a very early age. So it wasn't that like, you know, my mother wasn't like cooking meals like regularly, but like every now and then, like we had to make our own food, you know, like for ourselves, like the majority of the time. And that kind of, I think because my brother is the only boy and he's so spoiled and such a mama's boy for my mother, it's kind of just like, oh, Eric, you know, like, you don't have to do anything. And he like clung to that like so hard. And it's so interesting because he saw, Eric was around so many strong women all of his life, and he saw like everything that we did. And for a while I was very scared and nervous, like what, like was he going to just be the typical stereotypical man who just like sits on the couch and watches sports and his wife like cooks whatever. My brother is engaged to an amazing woman.
She's wonderful.
Who does not like to cook? Yes, Nicole. Who does not cook? And Eric has now become
the cook. Stepping up to the plate.
Will
I'm
I eat his
it.
Food? No.
You know.
But you know what?
Give
his
him
wife
a few
will.
Years.
His wife
and
will.
Maybe he'll get to a level of edibility.
Edibility. So I just think it's so interesting. That can be a word.
Okay.
That can be a word. I just think it's interesting how, you know, we see like what our parents do, how we either, you know, replicate that or how we go our own like path. It's very interesting to see like how those gender roles like kind of, you know, pass down. Because in Liberian culture, I think it's very like a man is a man and a woman is a woman by the most like
archaic definition.
Yes. So like very much so the man takes out the trash, the man does the long, like, cuts the grass.
Yes.
And the woman,
and then he comes inside and the woman brings him a like a plate full
yes.
of food
for everyone, like cooks for everyone and brings it to
them.
Yes.
Literally.
And serves them.
Yeah.
And so it's just interesting how our kind of perspective on gender roles being first gens has been kind of a hodgepodge in being able to decipher and know like what equality in the house really means.
This is Jorge's story.
My name is Jorge Malares, and I identify as a first-generation American of Cuban descent.
Got it. All right, so we know you're from the lovely 305.
305.
M.I.A. That's what it sounds like down there.
Yeah. Like all the time.
All the time, yeah.
It's amazing. So tell us about growing up in Miami.
Growing up in Miami was really interesting. Very different than probably the rest of America. So Miami is one of the most multicultural cities in the country. So on my block, you know, I had, you know, white people. I had, you know, obviously Latino people, Haitian people, LGBTQs living. I mean, I had a friend who, you know, had same-sex marriage parents. So it was a very diverse city and very different than I guess what some would picture across America, because regardless of where you came from, everybody just kind of work together. There's a lot of things about Miami that I wish I could change. Hence why I moved to beautiful Charlotte, North Carolina. But if there's one thing that it actually has that I think the rest of America needs to have is that diverse environment and that acceptance of it. So that it was an interesting time. I mean, and a lot of parties, a lot of good times, and I met a lot of great people, made a lot of great friends. But I love going back down to Miami to visit, but I love living here in Charlotte.
So tell us, what role did gender play in your household growing up?
Gender in my household, I was an only child, and just kind of seeing the way that my parents lived their life is very different than the gender roles in my house. You know, so in my house, you know, my mother, you know, she would work 9 to 5. She would come home. She would cook. She would clean. She would do the laundry. She would do homework with me. And all the while, my father, who I love dearly, was sitting on the couch watching the Florida Marlins play baseball, or the Miami Marlins now, but they were the Florida Marlins back then. So I did see a big difference in terms of, you know, the way that they both, you know, their roles within the home. And I think that was probably the biggest difference. For me personally, being an only child, as an only child and being a male, it was pushed upon me that, hey, you got to be strong. You can't cry. You know, you can never cry in front of people. It's a sign of weakness. You can never really show too much emotion because now people will think differently of you and think, again, that it's a sign of weakness. And that was something that was instilled in me, you know, from my stepfather himself. But it was interesting because then for my mother, it was totally different. You know, she's like, it's okay to cry. You know, it's okay to show weakness sometimes. It's okay to, you know, have, you know, a softer side and a softer approach to certain things. So I think for me, ultimately, it ended up being a pretty decent balance. Again, I'm far from perfect, but it was a good balance altogether because I got a little bit of both worlds there, for, you know, at least from both of their perspectives, which were wildly different. When you're an only child, you're it. You're the only one. So as a Cuban American, you know, first of all, Latinos, for those of you that don't know, are very affectionate people, specifically with their children. So being the only one, there was a lot of awesome, you know, I was showered with, you know, affection from my mother at all times, showered with gifts, you know, and showered with love. So it did help me kind of understand that and made me an affectionate person. So yeah, being an only child and then being a man, it also made me strong because I've learned some of the things, you know, like I was forced to take out the garbage every day and do some of these so-called manly things, right? And ultimately to go to school and make sure that I was doing well, because the man is, you know, in Latino culture, the head of the household, he's the guy. So it doesn't matter. Like it would never, there's never going to be a point, you know, at least in my house where I was growing up, where my mother would be the head of the household. No. My stepdad was the head of the household and he was the one. And if he, you know, whatever he said went, you know, my mother could have opinions. She could have, you know, thoughts and different things that she could say and suggest things. But at the end of the day, his decision was the final one. So it played a role with me because I didn't want to, in my home, I didn't want that environment. You know, so with my girlfriend, Jensen, we collaborate. There's a lot of teamwork. I cook for her. She'll cook for me. You know, we do things together. We really just, we're a team. You know, and not to say that my parents weren't a team. They were a team. And it's almost like when you think about a football team where, you know, the kicker just goes out there and just kicks the ball every now and then. He'll probably never tackle anybody. That would be one heck of a kicker if we could find that guy. You know, but everybody kind of knew their role, where at least in my home, we share the role and share the responsibilities. And that's something that it did shape me, because seeing the way that they operated made me want to operate differently and operate as a true team where we both kind of share the responsibilities. So my grandmother passed away when she was 104 years old, and she never worked a day in her life, not one, you know, not a full day at least. So the story I hear is she tried to get a job in Cuba working at a supermarket, and about 3 hours in, her husband, my grandfather, walks in and says, "Come with me, you're not doing this." So he just literally escorts her out of the supermarket. And she just learned from that moment on, okay, well, I guess I won't work. You know, now granted, they had 5 kids, which are my aunts and uncles and my mother. But yeah, it definitely came from theirs, guy. It came from, you know, my mother seeing the way, you know, I guess it was almost a learning experience for her too, because she never, my mom always wanted to work. And I think part of that was knowing that, you know, my grandmother was prohibited from working. So since she was prohibited from working, when my mother said, I want to be independent, I want to work. And she started working at a very young age here when she came to the States. She came when she was 12. And by the age of 16, she was already working. And I may be wrong. It may even be earlier. So she may hear this and say, no, I started working when I was 14. But yes, it definitely came from my mother seeing my grandmother as a homemaker, as I used to call them, and just stay at home. And understanding that, yes, she will cook, she will clean, but I think it made her want to do more and almost be the superwoman that does it all. I'm not only a homemaker, as I used to call them, air quotes on that, right? But no, she I also work, so I'm a little bit of everything. And I'm more than a woman is traditionally supposed to be within the Latino and Cuban culture. When I think about my parents and them working for somebody for a very long time, I mean, my mother worked for Univision, which is a great, you know, Spanish, big Spanish television chain here in the States. She worked there for almost 40 years and retired. That's great. She's happy. But I guess it's one of those conversations where you talk about you don't want to be like your parents in certain things. There's a lot of things I do want to be like my mom. I mean, I think she has so many amazing qualities that, quite frankly, I would only aspire to have half of them. But when it comes to working for someone else for that long, I don't think it's something that sits well with me. And what it really doesn't sit well, piece that doesn't sit well with me about it is, you're really just, at that point, you're just on this rat race where you're just going over and over and over in circles. And next thing you know, 40 years has gone by and you haven't really been able to accomplish some of the things that you're passionate about. Money isn't everything, but financial freedom does allow you to help others. And that's one thing that I'm extremely passionate about, is helping others, you know, and just, you know, investing into the community. But somebody very wise once told me, poor people can't help poor people. The entrepreneurial piece is that's in my heart. It'll never go away. And that's why I started Queen City Unity with a great group of people, because that's my passion. And that's really the direction that I want to go in, because I want to wake up every morning and say, I'm going to make a change. I'm going to go do something positive. I think the independence of being an entrepreneur allows you to have a bigger impact and then really focus on the things that you want to do. I think it's been potentially easier because I'm a male, and I'm not saying that makes it right. Actually, I think it's wrong. But I do think it has been a little bit easier. I really do admire female entrepreneurs, because they are going against what 30 or 40 years ago most people would have thought of an entrepreneur. I can guarantee you, if you polled 100 people right now and said entrepreneur, some of the names that will come up, give me the top 10 names of the top 10 entrepreneurs. Right off the bat, you're going to start talking about, you know, Jobs, right? Steve Jobs. You're going to start talking about, you know, Mark from Facebook, right? It's going to be a lot of male names, you know, and if you actually look a little deeper, there are a lot of very successful female entrepreneurs, but for some reason, the perception is entrepreneur, male, right? So I do think it has been easier, but again, I don't think that makes it right. And part of what I think we need to focus on as a society is making it equally challenging to be an entrepreneur, but also equally accessible to be an entrepreneur. Ever since I was young, you know, I would be with my youth group and we would do a lot of different community activities. You know, I think a lot of it probably has to do with my upbringing and seeing how giving, you know, my parents were, and seeing how they would go out of the way. Like if there was somebody, you know, if we were stuck in traffic, there's a lot of people out in the streets of Miami asking for money. You know, my mother would be quick to roll down the window and give a dollar or two, whatever she could spare, knowing that. And that's why I look back on it now and I'm like, gosh, but we were a little bit strapped for cash ourselves, but we were absolutely blessed to be here. You know, my mother always told me, we are blessed to live in America because it's a free country. And I used to ask her, well, what does that mean? She's like, well, you can just about say or think anything, because in the island of Cuba, there's political oppression where if you say anything against the government, that might be your last day on the island, my last day on earth, really. So I think seeing that and seeing her giving spirit and seeing her heart really opened me up to saying, well, I am blessed and I should be able to bless others with the things that I've been given and help them. The number one thing that having a presence in the community stands for me is that it's not about you. It's not about you. And I've seen other organizations come and go, and even some other organizations out there, that it's about the people doing it. It's about, okay, it's about me, me, me. And that's not what it's about. You know, it's about being selfless and being a voice for some of the people that don't have the courage to stand up and be that voice. And knowing that when there's some wrong in the community, just, again, having the courage to stand up and say, this is wrong, and we need to fix this, and we need to correct this. And then not just talk about it, because I do think that, you know, there is some value in a protest because you're expressing your opinion. But then what are the action items that come from it? You know, if all we do is protest, that's all we're doing. It's like my kids. You know, my kids can kick and scream about anything they want, but if they don't take some action items to correct the issue, well, then there is no solution. All we're doing is just protesting. And I think that being present in the community, again, is being that voice for the people that don't have a voice, being the person that stands up and says, there's a wrong and we're going to right it, and then just helping anybody that's in need. There are so many different needs, you know, whether it's financial needs, whether it's emotional needs, whether it's discrimination, you know, whether it's, you know, gender inequality. It doesn't matter what it is, but being present and knowing, and people knowing, you know what, there's something wrong going on right now that's being done to me, or I'm at a disadvantage, and being present to me is come to me, and somebody turning and saying, you know what, we need to go that way, we need to talk to those people, because at that point you've earned the trust of the community, and that's what it starts with, being present in the community, having the trust of the community, being selfless, and truly making an impact, not just pretending you're making an impact. It's about truly making an impact. The Latinos here in Charlotte, they need a voice. And some of them, you know, specifically the undocumented ones, you know, they truly live in fear every single day. And they wake up every morning not knowing if it's going to be their last day here in the United States. And I know a couple, I mean, and it's a terrible story. I reached out to a good friend of mine and I say, hey, you know, would you, and we have a fundraiser coming up. I said, would you and your husband love to come? She's like, I can't because he's in jail and about to get deported. So there's kids involved. And to me, that's that particular piece of immigration and the immigration reform that needs to occur here in the United States altogether, that's something that I hold near and dear to my heart, because I've been absolutely blessed that my parents came here and that I'm a first generation American born here, so I don't wake up with those issues. But there are Mexicans, there are Cubans now that worry about that, there are all types of Latinos and people from all types of races and backgrounds that worry about that, and that's something that I'm very passionate about, because again, I've been blessed with being a first generation and I don't have to worry about that, but we want to be the voice. I want to be the voice for the people that don't, they can't have a voice, because the moment they stand up, it could be their last day here. September of 2016, you know, when the shooting of Keith Lamont Scott, you know, and the community reaction to it that really led to a lot of friction on both sides, that was the day that really started the inception of Queen City Unity. And ultimately, I reached out to some good friends, some good business partners and colleagues that I had from back in the day here growing up in Charlotte. And I said, hey, let's get together. We got to do something. And at the time, we didn't know what the heck we were going to do. We just knew something had to be done. So we meet in my living room, the seven of us just there talking about the civil unrest and, you know, the Keith Lamont Scott shooting and all the different things that came about as a result of that. And then we said, okay, well, we don't know what we're going to do, but let's come up with a mission statement. That should probably give us some direction. So we came up with our mission statement, which is to bring people together of all races, religions, gender, and sexual orientation and socioeconomic status here in Charlotte in order to create unity. And that was really the concept of it. And when we came up with the mission statement, we said, well, now what? Well, let's come up with our initiatives. How do we drive that? Because it's a very broad mission statement, but it's intentionally broad because it needs to be all-encompassing. So we come up with our four pillars of unity. which the four pillars of unity is what we consider to be our core initiatives. Very first one is let's work with other nonprofits and help the community. There's already a bunch of beautiful and great nonprofits here in Charlotte. Let's not try to reinvent the wheel. You know, we want to help students with school supplies, but we have great, you know, great organization called Classroom Central. Let's work with them, right? You know, we want to help people that don't have the means to buy the nourishment, the food that they need. Well, Second Harvest Food Bank of Metro Atlanta, it's a great organization. Why reinvent the wheel? So we started working with them, and we made that our very first priority, is working with other nonprofits. And since then, we've done a lot of work with a lot of different ones across the city and really just helped out to a point where we wanted to be, and this is the one thing we said, we wanted to be a pool of volunteers, because I think that's the number one thing that a lot of nonprofits struggle with is bodies, people, right? Human capital, like who can help? You know, they're constantly looking for volunteers. So we wanted to become that pool of volunteers. The second initiative was to host community events and festivals that promote diversity and inclusion. So one of those being our Charlotte Unite Festival. So we had our first annual Charlotte Unite Festival last year, and we're really looking forward to the second annual one. Should be a good time. But that was the other one, is come up with community events. We'll continue to do that. And the other two are become an informational news source for people in the community and really start spreading the message of diversity and inclusion by education, because it's fear that really drives discrimination and racism. And the more we educate people, the more that they'll start feeling more comfortable and expanding their comfort zone around people that are different than them. So that was the third initiative. And then the final initiative is to legally represent anybody that's been discriminated against, which we have a couple good team of volunteers that are attorneys, and they will legally represent anybody. Fortunately, nobody's taken us up on that offer yet, so no news is good news there. But in 2018, you know, one of the things that we do have planned is community programs for the youth and doing some diversity education with them, because we think that's really important. But that's how we started, and we started back in October of 2016, and since then it's been an amazing ride. We've really met a lot of great people. And you know, I will say one thing I learned personally was that when we met in October of 2016, I thought the world was a very negative place. And there is a lot of negativity in it. There's no way around it. But what I've realized in the last year of my life is that there's actually more positivity that outweighs that negativity. And to me, that was a real big life lesson, because if you look at the media, you're constantly watching TV, all you hear about is the negative things in the world. But if you're actually on the grassroots level, you start realizing, you know what, there's actually more positivity, and it's time for us to start highlighting that. But that was the inception of Queen City Unity, where we started, and just continue to grow from there, I hope. So people don't understand the political oppression in Cuba. You know, they just assume that Cuba is a poor country, that, you know, just people just, there's a lot of poverty, and there is. What they don't understand about Cubans and Cuba is that if you look back to the 60s, when, you know, Fidel Castro took reins of Cuba, he created a party that, you know, really did not and limited everybody in terms of freedom of speech. There was no freedom of speech. There were no protests. If there would have been a protest, there would have been a shootout. There would have been a massacre. People would have been incarcerated. So anybody that stood up against that government was incarcerated or shot. And I know a good amount of people that are friends of mine that have family members that are no longer with us, because they were courageous enough to step up. But ultimately, it was a very short fought battle, because there was not much of a battle. So I think the very first one is that Cubans choose, you know, to be in Cuba, because that's one thing I've heard a lot is, well, if it's so bad in Cuba, then why don't they just leave? Well, they can't. And it's not because they can't leave because they have to wait years and years for some sort of immigration process. It's that there truly, really isn't much of an immigration process. You have to jump on a raft or cars that have been made with subpar materials. I saw a Cadillac, a 1960-some Cadillac, that had been made into a flotation device. And that's how these Cubans got here. And if you're willing to risk your life at sea for days, to for liberty, for freedom, there's a problem in that country. And I think that's one of the major stereotypes that I think needs to go away, is that Cubans don't choose to be in Cuba. There are some that actually enjoy the way of life there, but a majority of them don't want to be there. They want progress. They want a democratic government. that allows them to have free capital and be able to actually open up businesses. And I do think in the last year there has been a little bit of progress there ever since the death of Fidel Castro. But Raul Castro, his brother, is actually still running the island. So I think that's the biggest one, is that it's not a choice. There's no freedom of speech. There is absolutely no freedom. And liberty is dead in Cuba. And people need to know that, because I don't think enough people know that. They always say Cubans are some of the most hardworking people on the planet. And growing up in a home where I saw my parents bust their hump day after day after day, I think that is something I'm very proud of, because I've been told throughout my life is your work ethic is insane. And I don't know if it's genetically embedded in me or if it's actually just provided through experiences and seeing it, but I am very proud to be a Cuban American, because number one, I'm very hardworking. Number two, you know, it's just amazing people. I think, you know, if you really kind of embed yourself to the culture of Cuba, even the Americans that I've spoken to that have traveled to the island, they will tell you some of the most welcoming people you can ever imagine. You look at some of those streets out in Cuba and you go, gosh, that looks like, doesn't look like the kind of neighborhood I want to walk down. But some of the friends that I've had that have gone to Cuba, they tell me they just walk down those neighborhoods and they're welcomed with rum, and they're welcomed with cigars, and they're welcomed, you know, as visitors. And I think it makes me proud to know that I'm part of a culture that is a hardworking, you know, culture that'll fight for their, you know, fight for freedom, you know, risk our lives to come get freedom here in the United States. And that at the same time, once we get here, we don't expect the government to give it to us all. We're going to work hard for it. And that makes me very proud. Cool. Well, thank you guys. Appreciate it.
Awesome. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed what you heard, subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcast. It helps other people find us. We can also be found on SoundCloud and wherever else you get your podcasts. Check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at First Gens. That's the number one, STGENS. Plus, get extra content on our website, firstgenspodcast.com. It's really a dope site made with Squarespace, so go check it out. First Gens was created by my amazing cousin, Perrine DeShield. The show is co-hosted by myself and Perrine. All music heard in this episode was created by Nick Stubblefield, our amazing musical composer, and Trey Pierce, aka Self, who is our audio engineer. Thank you to our roundtable crew, Jorge, Diana, Jeannie, and Emmanuel. First Gens is a proud member of Huga, an amazing co-working space based out of Charlotte, North Carolina. Thanks for all your love and your support.